All right, welcome to History Through Art, week 12 for the junior and senior high class. Before we return to our painting from last time, I want to announce your first writing assignment, which is going to be due on Monday. And so you'll be receiving a written or email confirmation of it. And if you do not receive one today, either at your parents' email or at your email address, then you need to contact me immediately. Actually, what I will do in addition to posting it on it by email is I will post it on the class webpage. So however it is that you need to get your hands on it, the absolute, you know, the unshakably, what's the right word here? The method you can rely on 100% if email doesn't work is that it will be posted to the class webpage. So get it there, and it's announced officially in class, so no excuse for not doing it. It's a short-term assignment, and it's due on Monday. So here it is. And don't try to copy this down today. Just make a note of it, and you know that you have 3 full days to work on it, basically, and you're going to be handing it in on Monday. And so the assignment is going to be this: a paragraph length writing assignment. And the title is "The World We Live In." And what you will do is you will write a description of the world we live in using 4 anchor facts. And so, that's it. 4. So in other words, your task is to choose from the anchor facts that we have, the 4 anchor facts that describe the most the world that we live in, and go ahead, say what it is. Tell us. Basically, in a very short description, the world we live in is ... and you tell the reader what kind of world it is, and of course, using the anchor facts, where that came from. So, to give you a brief kind of example, right? The world we live in is a globalized world. If you choose to relate that particular fact, certainly one of the strong candidates for inclusion in your paragraph, then which of the anchor facts, and indeed which fact from history is the single most instructive fact to explain to somebody else how it is that we came to live in a globalized world? Which would you choose? Is it Manning's Armor? The fall of the Roman Empire? Is anybody hearing me? Are you in stunned silence and you have no answer to this? What's going on?
Sorry, Mr. Call, for me, you cut out for 5 or 10 seconds.
Oh, for crying out loud. All right, so Keen says I cut out for 5 or 10 seconds. Griffin, was that what you were going to tell me?
No, I was just going to answer the question. I think that Menes Narver, the signing of Declaration of Independence, the birth of Jesus.
No, I'm not asking you for all of the facts that you would choose. I'm asking you which of the facts would you use to describe globalization?
I think you would have to choose Christopher Columbus sailing.
Yeah, because we're talking about all the cultures of the world being connected to each other, all of the continents of the world being connected to each other. Right, so the theme is the world we live in. So you would want to say, what kind of world is it? What do we know about it because of what? Right, so it's globalized. What do you think would be another theme that you would represent, would make sense to represent in a story of the world that we live in? What are the other features of that world that we have highlighted so frequently here? What's another feature that you would want to include in your paragraph? Bria, go ahead.
What of the world is ruled by monarchy, and we're the only country that is not that way?
Oh, okay. No, be careful. Now, that is a trap that you could fall in. Historically speaking, almost everybody has been ruled by monarchy. However, that is no longer true, Bria, so be careful. Okay? In fact, the currently most prevalent form of government is democracy. So that is another strange feature of the world. But that also is very new and very different. So be careful. So that if you describe the world as currently as being dominated by monarchy, you'll be wrong. So no, that's not what we said about Manes Narmer. We said that throughout history, monarchy has been the most prevalent form of government until America. That's what we said. So be careful not to mischaracterize where we are now. Okay, Keen?
I would say that the world we live in is a European world, and I would use the fall of the Roman Empire in 476 AD to characterize that or to be our example of what...
Okay, so that's a choice. That's a choice. Keen is saying he's going to think about, well, the world we live in is a European world, partly because of what I just said, that the world is democratic and the Europeans stand for that. Maybe he's going to focus on that feature. It's not a Roman or Greek world. It's a European world. Columbus discovered America. These explorers went out into the world and shaped it. All right, so Keen wants to say it's a European world. All right, well, it is, but it's also a world with one absolutely preeminent country. And if you're missing out on that one, then well, you might have an interesting story. I mean, that's the thing is, if you don't want to choose 1776, you don't have to. But the story that you're going to end up saying about the world is going to be a really interesting, very different story, isn't it? So if you're going to choose 1776, what are you going to be saying there in your story of the world that we live in? What are you going to be saying using that anchor fact? Alexander?
That America is pretty much the most important country in the world right now, and they have, I forgot what the word was, but they have the most important culture and the most military power, and, well, not the most important culture, that doesn't exist, but the most widespread culture, and the strongest military power, and the richest.
Okay, so I don't know what your reticence is concerning the word important. Those are the characteristics of the most important culture. Important does not necessarily mean good or bad. Important means all of those, that listing of things. So preeminent across all domains, essentially, or almost all, if not all, but I think it's pretty much all. So militarily, politically, culturally, economically, America is preeminent. So it just stands way above everybody else. So that's objectively the most important country in the world. You don't have to be afraid of saying that. It's not the same thing as saying the best. That's a more challenging statement. But it is absolutely the most important. Okay, so, yeah. Or the word you were looking for there was, Alexander, was America-centric. Okay, so I think I'm getting the sense here that you guys are going to appreciate a little bit of extra guidance in the assignment, and I will include that if you're feeling like, oh, you wouldn't have any clue how to proceed in writing this one or choosing the four that you're going to choose. I think I'm going to include a little bit of extra guidance with regard to the so whats to remind you of them. Of course, apart from the assignment questions themselves, where are you going to be looking in order to give you a little bit of a boost in writing the assignment. What is your main resource for kind of working over the content here that's going to end up in this little paragraph? What's your main resource? Alexander?
The class notes?
Class notes. Simple as that. And certainly the earliest of the class notes, because that's where we talked about the anchor facts. We're really only starting to get a certain kind of integrated picture of the anchor facts, but I elaborated on the story of the anchor facts, the idea of the anchor facts at the beginning of the course. So go there, reread those, think about the so what's, which will be discussed in the assignment, and then make your choice. And we'll see. It'll be interesting to see what the choices are. You got four. You're going to choose four of them, and I want you to tell me about the world that we live in, and we'll see which ones you choose and which ones you think are the most revealing. And in a sense, what I'm asking you to do is, which one of the seven are the top four? Right? This is kind of a part of the assignment here, is that if you only had to choose four, which would you use? Which of the seven facts really reveals the most about the world that we live in? So I'm not, you know, Bria, if you want to take that on right now, you can, just so other people will see how you're thinking about it. Go ahead.
Well, I would probably choose the one about Jesus Christ first.
Mm-hmm.
Columbus. I'm trying to remember all of them. What's wrong with me? Probably, let's see. I think the Twin Towers is pretty important because we live in a world of terror over terror or something like that. I can't think of the fourth one, but those would be my top three.
All right. Well, but before you choose like that, you have to make sure you've got all seven in front of you. And so let me give you that tip. Make sure you get the anchor fact timeline or the facts practice in front of you. Look over the seven. Make sure you can answer all the questions, which you should be able to because you've done facts practice and you guys performed very well in answering all the so what questions. And then once you can do that, then you can start to say, well, is this one more important than that one? So, you know, is monarchy more important than the fact that it was Europe that globalized the world? Weigh those against each other. Yes or no? Think about it. Which one's more important? Is America centrism more important than the precedent that helped establish the American Republic, the precedents of democracy and republic in ancient civilizations, and so on? Right? So which one of these tells me the most about my world now? Which one of these gives me the most powerful perspective on the world? So that I have this paragraph and it's called The World We Live In, and I have revealed as much as I can using four facts. That's the question. How much can you say about the world using four facts? All right, so that'll be it. Like I said, you'll get a written confirmation of the assignment, and it will be posted to the class webpage. So make sure you look there, and it will be due on Monday. Not before class on Monday, but on Monday. So you have even Monday to work on it, and I will remind you on Monday, if I haven't received yours yet, that you're on your last day to hand it in. All right, and so, good. Well, we'll see how that goes, and we'll go from there. We have a painting to go back to. It's a painting that has a lot of interesting challenges to it, so I'm eager to see what you guys can come up with. Let's look at it. So, we talked last time about the main character in black, who is gesturing to himself and indicating something to his side, down and to the side. We have yet to discuss what it is that he might be gesturing to, but we're going to take a close look at that today. We know also that he's looking at another person, the queen, and that she is not looking at him. In fact, has raised her hand to shield herself from his quite intense gaze. A gaze that's really highlighted by the use of light and shadows that turns him, that really makes it quite a dark and ominous look. Very severe. And she is shying away, embarrassed, refusing to look at him. So that is kind of, we were able to get through to our two main characters the other day and see that the painting involves a dynamic between them. That this is the most important relationship in the painting. And so when we end up describing the painting in a single sentence, we'll want to focus on that, but we won't want to miss out on the full context of the painting as well. So the next thing to do then, assuming we've done a good job of characterizing characters one and two, is to look at character number three, the king, and try to identify what it is that he represents. So, on that note, tell me what you see. Keen, go ahead.
One of the first things I noticed was the similarity in gesture between the king and the men standing in black. It's not the same, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, but it is very similar. He has that same hand to the chest. Fingers aren't as straight, but it's a marked similarity that I noticed.
Both. Well, yeah, the fingers are not straight, so you can see. You're right, hand to the chest. So, yeah, absolutely. Looking at the hands, and you know, hand gestures are a big part of body language, right? And so this man's fingers are straight, and he's pointing to himself. This man's fingers, though, are curled. And he has a necklace right here, which he seems to be clasping. So his hand is up to his chest, but it's more in the manner of him gently kind of fidgeting with this thing around his neck. So he's just kind of loosely gripping the object around his neck. All right, so what could we make of that? Well, we'd have to kind of look at what else we can see. So what else can we see? Priya, go ahead.
I noticed this man behind the man that's standing next to the king, or a woman, it could be either one. It looks like they're writing down something, maybe like a court scribe or something like that.
Yeah, okay, alright. So that doesn't help us with this character in particular. It's a good observation. And yeah, there are some unusual looking characters there in the background that are kind of compelling. But it doesn't really help us with the king. So help me with the king.
Well, he kind of looks like he's pondering something.
Okay, why?
Because the man in the black obviously has...
No. I mean, what are you seeing?
I see he's holding something in his left hand. Scroll of paper.
Okay, he's holding a scroll of paper. All right.
And he has a chain around his neck.
All right, we already said he's got a chain around his neck. He's probably clasping this little amulet or whatever it is there, kind of fidgeting with it. All right, he's holding a scroll in his left hand, but those don't speak to your evaluation. What was your interpretation again?
He was pondering something.
Okay, what's the visual evidence for that?
Eye contact.
The visual evidence is his gaze. His gaze is unfocused and off and into the distance. Right? He's looking off into the distance and he's just kind of not paying attention to anything. Alexander.
I'd say he's either pondering something or bored or sort of one of those two, maybe.
Yeah, right. So either...
He's just looking at something on the wall. Either there's a window there, he could be looking out the window, or he's looking at one of those mosaics, and he's just not really paying attention and fidgeting, and
Right. So it's a combination of all those, and I suppose it doesn't really matter so much, right? His gaze is pretty unfocused. So it suggests, rather than pondering, where he might be kind of considering something, it suggests more indifference, not caring. In a scene where the main character is very intense and the lady in yellow is embarrassed, he is detached. He's not a part of this. It's as if, okay, you guys sort that out, and meanwhile, I'm gonna go and daydream. And it's as if he's not a part of it. So that's weird. So he seems to be, he's disconnected from this. He is, what was the word I was looking for? Yeah, I'm using all the same words. Detached, disconnected. No, that wouldn't be the one. Disinterested, indifferent. Yeah, they're all pretty much mean the same sort of thing. Okay. So, which sets him apart, actually. Because among all the other characters, for instance, look at the man in red. And we have a lot of characters here, especially over on the left-hand side, right, who are actually very focused on the man, on the main character, right? Look at his gaze is very direct. And more than that, how would you characterize the man in red? We know that you may or may not know that the red is an outfit that denotes his religious offices. All right, but that doesn't seem to play in here. It's not like we're in a church or we're doing anything religious. He's really shown in another way. So what is he shown as? What do we see here? What kind of person is this? And what is his reaction to the man in black? Bria?
His gaze is very intense. As you can see, his eyebrows are kind of raised.
And yeah.
His eyes are kind of big. And to me, it's kind of ominous, sort of.
Yeah, it's also ominous similarly to the main character, because they both have a lot of shadow on them. Yeah, and so we can't even see his eyes, it's so dark. There's a lot of shadow on this character, and it does seem kind of ominous. I agree. So he's also kind of a severe character, and he's also pensive, right, with his hand up to his chin. That's kind of a thinker's gesture, right? Like the thinker, you guys know that statue where he's resting his chin on his fist, right? So in this case, it's not quite as severe, right? But it's a gesture that we associate with thoughtfulness, right? When somebody's thinking, it's very common for them to, I do it a lot, especially when I haven't shaved, I will just fidget with my chin, and play with the hair or whatever, right? That when, it's kind of a standard gesture of men who are deep in thought. I don't know as much about women. As far as fidgeting with the chin is concerned, this lady, for instance, also has a kind of considered pose. She's also paying close attention to the main character. In a different way. Her posture, her gesture are perhaps a little bit more feminine. It's kind of an interesting contrast. Each and every one of these characters has his unique kind of reaction to the main character. This lady has her hand across her waist, and then the other hand, the other elbow resting on it, and then up her hand up kind of towards her shoulder. And that gives her a kind of thoughtfulness, too, in the way she's kind of leaning back. And then she also is very intently looking at the main character. It's less judgmental, but it seems to involve a certain kind of curiosity and even confusion. A little bit of a, I'm not sure about this guy. He's more, I really am interested. And apart from his gaze and his chin, his kind of fidgeting with his chin, is there any more evidence of his intent or evaluation? If a person were looking at you like this, what would you see and what would you read from their posture and gesture and that sort of thing, Alexander?
Well, his hand is like his elbow is sticking out and his hand is on the banister, and it's like he's going to stand up. I'm not sure if he is because one of his feet is off the floor, so I don't really know. But he's uncertain and like. He's getting himself into a slightly uncomfortable position. he's uncertain about this.
That's very interesting. I like that because, yeah, this gripping of the armrest suggests some tension. And you're right that his seated posture is quite unnatural. It's uncomfortable. So it indicates a certain discomfort inside, right? It's kind of a projection or a visualization of his state of mind, which is a little bit agitated, right? And unease is another good word, right? So he's intensely considering what the man in black has to say, and he's not comfortable with it. Yeah, I would definitely put, I think that's a pretty good summary right there. That was a good reading. That was a good reading that Alexander about this unease and this discomfort. Okay. So, all right. I like that. Anybody see another character that they feel would kind of help us characterize the moment? We have a large audience. Right, that we are viewing. Is there anybody else who is viewing the main character, reacting to him in some way that you think might be significant? Or is there anybody else who is viewing one of the other main characters whom you might think would be significant? A lot of characters to choose from. Kind of in the way that the standard here is there anybody else that would go into our one sentence explanation of the painting? Is there anybody that we would single out and say, you know, they are doing something or that we would want to include, right? What do you think? Or are they just extras like in Hollywood when you got 50 people in a scene and they're just interchangeable? Bria?
I don't know. I may be wrong. But I think the woman with the black hair is actually looking at the guy who has that weird hairdo thing.
Well, yeah, okay. I get your point. You mean this guy over here? It's a feather cap on top of his knightly outfit. So he's a little bit of a dandy, but... So, you know, he's a knight of some sort, and he seems to be looking over at the queen, cocking his head to the side to kind of see her more clearly. So he's an interesting character that way. But I don't see that he contributes much other than he's very interested. I like him as a character because he's very interested in the queen. So by doing that, he kind of puts more emphasis on her and reminds us that the scene has to do primarily with the man in black, his statement, his presentation, his action, and then the reaction of the king and queen. The reaction has two parts. One of them is embarrassment. One of them is indifference. And then maybe, added to that, curiosity by the lady and serious discomfort and interest by the cardinal. Well, that's four quite significantly different reactions to the same statement. Or the same, what have you, the same exposition that this man in black is making. So then our goal must be to try to figure out what is that? What is that exposition? What does it concern? And what's happening here? Right, so the question boils down to, what is he gesturing to? We know it's about him. But then the other part of his gesture is the left hand. And the left hand says, look over here. All right, so let's follow that command. The left hand says, look over here. All right, let's look over there. Keen, what do we see when that happens, when we look there?
All right, I see immediately the manacles that are open on the ground. And then,
okay.
You know, it's possible his hand is not totally, his hand is more gesturing to the people who are over there in reality than the manacles. But the people, they're interesting, but they do not have nearly the significance that the manacles seem to have, although I don't know what that significance is as of yet. Those manacles.
Yeah, why do the manacles stand out?
They are lit up. They're slightly they're quite a bit separated from everything else. They're just out in the middle of an empty floor, at least most of them, set. And they, you know, it's unusual. It's not something you really expect.
It's
the medieval theme, but it's not something you expect to see in the middle of the floor.
Yeah, that I think that's the key there, is that they don't fit. They don't belong here. Right? We don't have any indication of any other content in this image that suggests that we have crime or imprisonment or punishment. And then your comment that they are open, I think, is pretty interesting. And of course, open and not on anybody in particular. So that could be read a lot of different ways. Does anybody want to suggest the interpretation of open handcuffs, right? As opposed to, I think it matters that they're open versus closed. What do they suggest? Especially the symbol of handcuffs, right? And they are open. Rhea?
Well, when I saw them, I thought someone said something wrong. But then, after I thought about it for a minute, I thought maybe it means it's sort of, you make an agreement for something, you kind of make a promise.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now it's kind of like the deal is open, and you either say yes or you say no. If you say no, I'm leaving and taking it.
Oh, wow. Now that's very abstract, Bria. Very interesting. But that, I don't think that is the sensible interpretation in this context. I really like your idea of kind of like a binding promise. That's a great metaphor. But handcuffs are, let's put it this way, handcuffs are handcuffs. And so if you're going to suggest that they are something other than handcuffs, that they are a much more abstract representation, you really have got to have a reason why. So that is, you're going to have to make that case, which is, you might be able to. I've never thought of what you just said, so I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think handcuffs are handcuffs. Manacles are manacles, right? So in other words, they're used to bind somebody, to punish them, to imprison someone, right? So, and they're open. So, the fact that they're open, just leaving them as manacles for the time being. What does that say? Anything? Nothing? When we think about what they are as a symbol, does it say anything? Does it say anything? Like that?
Well, they mean that nobody is currently being handcuffed.
Okay, that's true, right? They're not being used. Okay, good. All right. So, does it mean... How about this? You know, sometimes I ask you guys, is this about to happen or did it already happen? So with kind of, for instance, the open manacles, the question might be, have they been used or are they about to be used? What would be the most kind of appropriate interpretation in this case? That they have been used or that they are going to be used? Which would it be here? Keen, what do you think?
I would have to say that they have been used because men both about to be used are not left like on the other
side. Yeah, I agree.
Confusing to me also, this applies to who these men both connected to because they're not connected to anybody. Like, my first thought is they're closest to the men in black, our main characters, so they keep wearing them. But you aren't imprisoned in these clothes. He doesn't look, his bearing is not of someone who has been already defeated or imprisoned. It's not over for him. He's making his case, whatever he's doing.
Well, okay. He's
just been on him.
All right.
They just doesn't have that bearing. People with handcuffs generally look kind of defeated. And if he had just had the handcuffs taken off, I don't think he'd be so upfront, you know?
Huh.
It's a stretch. I'm not totally sure about this stuff, yeah. But I'm confused. They're not connected to anyone.
Okay. Yeah, I get your point and I get your confusion. So that's very good. I mean, you're thinking along the right lines. Is the manacles don't fit. About everything that's going on in the scene, they feel the most discordant, right? They feel the most out of place. So then you're exactly right, Keen, to be kind of interrogating that, trying to say, well, how do I make sense? How do we make sense of them being there? And again, the most sensible interpretation is they were on somebody and aren't. Because if they are to be used on somebody, they're not going to be there. So it's more like these are discarded manacles. They were once used and are not being used now. And if they are discarded, but evidently it's the main character who's making the presentation. So if he's showing objects to the king and queen, those are there because he wants to show them. So they're connected to him. Right? If we're gonna say, I mean, not only are they next to his feet, but essentially he's gesturing down towards this group of objects here. And so they're connected to him more than any other character. So then, I guess what we need to do is look a little bit around and see if that can help us, right? We need the context to try to inform the presence of the manacles. So, what do we have? What do we have in the context? What are the other two things that the man is gesturing to? Not necessarily easy to make out in detail, right? But, Bria?
It looks like the boy is holding some sort of flag.
Yeah, all right. So one of the things is this boy here is stretching out and displaying some kind of banner, some kind of flag. Okay, right. So we have a flag. All right, we might be able to make out some of the features of it. The most I've been able to make out in the painting with any certainty is that there are golden anchors on a blue background. That's what these are. Golden anchors on a blue background. So anchors suggest what? Especially golden anchors on a blue background. The blue background would be the ocean, would be water, and anchors, of course, suggest boats, ships, right? So we've got some kind of nautical or marine reference on the flag. That's pretty significant. All right, so we've got a flag, a banner that has some marine symbols on it. And then we've got something else, and this is probably pretty, you know, this is going to be pretty consonant with that. What's this? Bria's typing too fast for her own good. Go ahead, Bria.
It's a map.
It's a map. Okay, right, it's a map. And so, I mean, it's not text because you can see that it's a sketch of different kinds of things. So it's a map. All right, so really quickly moving through, Alexander, settle down. Moving through the three objects, we have a map, a banner or a flag, and manacles. And so, does that help us? how does that strike you? Does that help us? Did that help any of you? I sense confusion continues to reign, Bria.
Maybe he's saying, I will bring back things for you guys.
Well, I'm not sure that fits the interaction that's ongoing here. And remember, we said the most likely interpretation of the manacles is they were once in use but no longer are. These are not manacles that are about to be used. So, Keen, go ahead.
I don't think these objects are able to help us very much yet because we can't or we haven't yet interconnected them. Like, the anchors and the map, they fit together sort of. Maps, seafaring, and then the anchors of the boats and seafaring. But as far as interconnecting the manacles, that's so far been eluding me, so I think we should do that.
Yeah, right. So that's a very good way of putting it, Keen. We can't seem to interconnect these, can we? Right? It's so what happens is, and that's so interesting, because a painting is going to, you know, the artist here has created a scene that has a logic to it. He has very deliberately positioned everything. This is a compositional masterpiece. Nothing is by accident. So, you know, why did he do this? In a sense, he made the entire painting in order to show the manacles. Because if there weren't any manacles here, that would be a really interesting painting, to just take them out. If we were to take out the manacles using a little Photoshop, maybe Timothy can do that for us and just reproduce the pattern of the carpet there and get rid of the manacles, then the painting would be totally different. Totally. Everything revolves around the manacles. It's as if that's it. It's the whole purpose of the painting is to show the manacles. But then, so how, that's the thing that we need to do here, Keen, is, like, as you said, how do we interconnect? Well, what we need to do is, like you said, we try to tie one thing to another, and look at each connection, each part of the network of connections. So we have, one of the things is we know that everything revolves around the main character. That's what we need to use, especially when we're trying to decipher narrative art. So we have a main character, and then we have these jarring objects, the manacles. So that's what we need to work with. And so I know it's a lot to carry, right? And that's the challenge here. And the artist has given us a lot. He's given us that the man, the main character, is gesturing to himself and the objects. So that already creates a connection, right? It creates me and these things. So he has done that for us. The artist has given us that clue. Me and these things. Map, flag, manacles. Me and the map, flag, and manacles. And then what? What else did the artist say? Using the main character as a bridge, What does the main character do in terms of interconnection? Perfect way to look at it, Keen. What is the function that he performs here in terms of interconnection? He says, me, these things, and where he's looking, you. So this is the painting right here. This is what it boils down to. When you remove all the clutter and you want to, you know, get to the heart of it, it's me, these things, and you. And of course, among the these things, the big standout jarring object is the manacles that were once used. And the thing that stands out over here is that she refuses to look at him. I think we can interconnect, Keen. It's not easy, right? So it's about kind of trying out formulations here. Me, the objects, and you. Look at the look. The severity of the look. The embarrassment and the refusal to look. The object that does not make sense in relation to the other objects. So what we're going to try to do here, since we are over time and we got to try, it's quite a colossal effort to undertake, but we got to try to put it together using a sentence, right? We are at least in a position to make a sentence that captures the puzzle, right? That captures the arrangement of the scene as the artist has presented it. So, a man stands before a king and queen and gestures to objects near him. All right, there we go. Good start. Good start. That's pretty good, right? But what do we need? A man stands before a king and queen and gestures to objects near him. All right, so Keen, go ahead.
We need some sort of adverb after gestures. It's not violently, but it's something like that. It's some li that gives us the emotion with which his gesture is being gestured.
All right, well, you're going to have to give it to me because I don't know which one to give it. So see what you can come up with. All right, but I'm going to go with some adjectives here. I'm going to go with a man stands. Before an uninterested king looking intensely at a queen who refuses to meet his gaze. Alright, I've done some pretty heavy lifting there. You guys gotta pick this up and keep going. A man stands before an uninterested king, looking intensely at a queen. Now, maybe what we need to do to shore that up is before a king and queen. A man stands before a king and queen, that's hard. So hard to say. I'm going to have to settle. Okay, so a man stands before an uninterested king, looking intensely at a queen, refuses to meet his gaze, and gestures to objects near him. So, We can take that further. What do we need here? This is not enough, is it? Gestures to objects near him? Not good enough. What do we need? Alexander?
Gestures to a map, a symbol of the sea, and a pair of manacles.
Well, we can't make out everything on the flag, so we're going to say a flag or banner and manacles. Is that how you spell manacles? There we go. Thank you, spell checker. And manacles near him. Yeah, I think we just have to list the objects. A map, a flag, and manacles. And there we go. That's my first title. A map, flag, and manacles. That's a heck of a title. Actually, not bad, because it's a weird enumeration of objects. So that's not a bad title. It represents the challenge of the That's not a bad one. The challenge of the manacles. That's got a lot of meaning, a lot of levels of meaning. That's like what Bria was talking about with the manacles being symbolic in different ways. That's a lot of layers right there. Because the challenge of the manacles is the challenge of understanding this painting. So that's like a different level altogether. But the challenge of the manacles is also what this scene is about. Because the man is looking at the queen and challenging her. And she is not up to the challenge. She won't look at him. And the king doesn't even care about the challenge of the manacles. The cardinal does, and the lady's quite curious about it, and everybody's here assembled in order to witness the challenge of the manacles. But the queen in particular cannot face this challenge. She's not up to it. Bria?
I'm sorry, I totally lost my mind.
Okay. All right. Any other what do you guys think? Give me a title. Okay, Bria.
The man's gaze speaks volumes.
The man's gaze speaks volumes? That's kind of cool. Okay, the man's gaze. Well, yeah, it does. That's neat. Okay. The manacles speak volumes. At least they ask us really difficult questions. What else? That too, right? The manacles. All right. So I'm really happy that we have stayed within the painting, I have to tell you, because if there's a temptation here that occurs if you start to identify too specifically with any objects or persons or what have you. So I want to say that I'm really, really happy that we did that, because what it allowed us to do was to face this mystery. It allowed us to face the puzzle as of the visual puzzle that is this painting, head on, without having the benefit of any external knowledge to shortcut our viewing of the painting. So I think that's been, for me, it's been a really productive experience, because I know too much, and I'm always kind of stuck knowing too much about paintings, and so that changes my experience. And I like this to be this guide that helps you struggle with the visual, because that's the beauty of visual art, is that it is visual. And it's such an interesting exercise to undertake art appreciation without just being, you know, the modern temperament just says, get me the answer. Just Google the answer. Give me the answer right now, and then go do something else after that, right? There's no this act of appreciation is kind of, I don't know, nowadays we're not focused on that enough. So it's an ability to have to really sit down and appreciate something very carefully and closely when it deserves it. Right? And so I really enjoy the process of guiding you through this, especially when you're so willing to be confused and state it and not be afraid of that, because nothing wrong with it. Right? If the artist has made a puzzle and not solved it for us, then he hasn't. Or, well, maybe he has, but he expects us to know more things. So, in fact, that's what's happened in this painting. That's what's happened in this painting. The artist expects us to have a certain historical context. He has created a very worthy representation of a moment in history, but the context is very specific, and he has given us the context. And so there's something that I think you guys might have mentioned last time, but did not mention today, which seals the deal almost here. So what is it that tells us, that starts to give us history here, rather than art? What is it in the painting that starts to say, this is a certain person in a certain place, rather than somewhere else? Right? What is it that does that, Timothy?
I believe that what really seals in the deal that this is history and not just a painting is that behind the king and queen, I believe, is the symbol of Spain at
right.
the time.
Exactly. Castile and León. Again, we keep seeing symbolism in our paintings. Castile and León. So, right, we are in Spain. And so, all right, so then we start to ask other questions, right? And who would this be confronting the king and queen? And then, well, the artist has given us more. And, well, the truth is, he expects us to know what this flag is. So, Bria, don't go. We're almost done. So he expects us to know what this flag is, and so I'm going to show you what it is. Hello? Where is it? The coat of arms of Christopher Columbus. The golden anchors on the blue background, the Castile and the León, the islands of the Caribbean, and the continental outline to which he was given title as Admiral of the Ocean Seas and representative of the King and Queen of Spain. Wow, okay. So once we have that as part of our context, that becomes a very different viewing, right? We know because of this that he is Christopher Columbus. We know that this is Ferdinand and Aragon. And then we again come back to the manacles. So, in order to solve that puzzle, you have to read the class notes. In order to solve that puzzle, you have to read the class notes. So, the second part of your homework for the weekend is to read the class notes and tell me, why are there manacles in this painting? The class notes hold the answer. And for you, Keen, it's going to have to be a little bit of a research project. The question is, I guess what I'm going to ask you guys on Monday is, after which of Christopher Columbus's voyage would this scene have occurred? Okay? The question I'm going to ask you on Monday is, after which of Christopher Columbus's voyages would this scene have occurred? And you should be able to get the answer in your notes, and if not, you can do a little bit of Googling and Wikipediaing and so on. But it's not too hard to find. So the details are there in the story. All right, good luck with that. We have the mystery of the manacles, the challenge of the manacles that we ourselves have been able to glean by viewing this image. The challenge of the manacles, I like that. So let's go find the answer in history, and then we'll know what it is that this artist intended for us to know, because the symbols are very specific. So we're going to have to combine our art appreciation process, which has been excellent, with that historical knowledge, and then we'll be done. All right, so good luck with that. Remember to look for the formal writing assignment on the class webpage and or in your email box, but on the class webpage in case you don't find it anywhere else. Last thoughts for today, anybody? Well, it was pretty intense, but I really like what you guys helped me to see, and I really like your contributions, because it came together as such an interesting outcome. There's only so much you can see without the history in this painting, and then the history creates an even greater kind of dilemma and challenge. So let's go find the answer in history. All right, guys, thanks for hanging around so long. I know we went long. I appreciate it. And so have a good weekend, and we'll talk again on Monday. Bye for now.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.